Hello and welcome to another episode of How Not to Make a Game. I'm your host Stuart Neil, and joining me on this episode is Manuela Malasana, a game developer and owner of the studio Team Dogpit. Hello.
Hey.
How are you?
I'm doing real well, and how are you doing?
I'm doing good. Thank you very much for coming onto the show and doing an interview and everything with me.
Well, thanks for having me.
Can you tell me a little bit about yourself and Team Dogpit?
I am a solo developer working with a tiny indie studio that's just me and any folks I happen to contract on short-term basis. I am approaching 30. I didn't get into programming or game dev at all until I was 25, so I'm a bit of a late bloomer, but I made up for lost time. And so far I've got five really strange, quirky titles out there, one of which is a commercial release, and I'm currently working on my sixth title and second commercial release.
Excellent. Just on the games that then you have released since about 2016 or so, you've released a few games on itch.io, and then in 2017 you released Slam Fighter 2 on Steam. How did the release of Slam Fighter 2 go?
Well, that's an interesting one because Slam Fighter 2 was originally set out into the wild in July of 2015. And it was a free title, and it was very different from the one you'll find on Steam today. So in 2017, I returned to it. Despite intervening years, it remained my most popular title, but it had several issues. It was made on a engine called XNA, which is by and large quite obsolete.
Yeah.
And it was a rhythm game where the rhythm was not syncing well. It was just not... It's a terrible, terrible thing to have for a rhythm game. So I rebuilt it from scratch, so all of the code is new and add new features. And so that was Slam Fighter 2 2.0. And that is the version that I released to Steam.
Oh, okay.
So it's fun.
Given your experience of having used both itch and Steam for releases and things, do you prefer using one over the other?
Well, without reservation, I can say that as a platform for a developer, itch is superior to Steam in every way. Their backend is much more up-to-date, more intuitive, easier to use. The problem is the way things are now in the market. If you are not on Steam, you basically don't exist.
Yeah.
Which is unfortunate. So if you want to be taken seriously as a developer, or even if you want people to take buying your game seriously, you have to have a presence on the Steam storefront, which is unfortunate because Steam takes a 30% cut. Itch lets you set the cut that they take, but I think a lot of people set it around 10%.
Oh, okay.
You can set it to be less than that, as far as I know, but... I want to give them my money. I want to support them.
Yeah, exactly. Do you think the now that Epic has their own storefront, do you think that is helping as competition against Steam?
That is an interesting question that I think is on all of our minds. And it's interesting for a number of reasons. So, you know, there have been a lot of platforms for retail games via the internet that have come up. Maybe familiar with, like Origin and Uplay and GOG Galaxy and even Discord Nitro. None of them have managed to really come close to rivaling Steam. And Steam basically has a monopoly on the PC games marketplace.
Yeah.
So the thought behind the Epic Game Store is that because they have so many millions of players who have the platform already to launch Fortnite, that's sort of your built-in audience right there. This was also the thinking behind the Discord store. And from what I've heard, that's not been an enormous success. So everybody's kind of got their eye on Epic. And from what I have seen so far, having the platform installed on a bunch of PCs is not quite translating into sales. But I'm not ready to call it DOA yet because it's still early on.
Yeah.
I think we're all waiting to see what happens because I think many devs are eager to see somebody break the monopoly stranglehold that Steam has on the market. But there's also a bit of trepidation because it's not like Epic's the good guys. They're just another guy.
Yeah.
So it'll be an interesting next several months.
Yeah. Currently another guy with an awful lot of money willing to throw at certain developers.
Yeah. What is it? From that Godzilla movie from several years ago, Let Them Fight.
Yeah. Just since the release of Slam Fighter 2, I've seen you mention on Twitter that you had been approached, hassled might be a better word for it though, by people basically looking for keys for the game. But on occasion, even whenever you have given them out and what have you, they have seemingly generated no coverage from it. Is that a frustrating situation? And do you think the people who are asking for the keys are genuinely wanting to give coverage, or are they just wanting to give freebies?
On this matter, I think it's a confluence of things. Game devs and influencers can often have a somewhat uneasy relationship because there's some dependence on some level, especially among indies, for positive word of mouth from these influencers. But there can be that tension when there's the perception of entitlement from these influencers.
Yeah.
But it also sucks because to some extent, perhaps that entitlement is grounded in some sort of real superiority, I hate to say. But on the other hand, you know, without games, well, I suppose these streamers would just play AAA games rather than indie games. So it's this uneasy thing of, you know, here's a thing that I spent years making and now I just need this rando. But I think there's kind of two forms of this. One is, I think if you get in the habit of getting free keys, it surely must be like a game in itself. You want to, you know, you want to just hoard keys, get cool stuff. It's fun to get swag. I like getting swag.
Yeah,
if I go to a conference, I'll go to the tables for things I won't even buy if they've got a free keychain. So on some level, I think it's that. On another level, there's a much more serious problem, and it's that there are a lot of niche industries that have sprung up related to basically extracting money from independent developers because they're vulnerable, because they're in a business where there is money going around, but they don't have the knowledge, institutional knowledge that would come from being part of a bigger studio. And one of these little cottage industries is key resellers. So one way that key resellers attempt to get keys to flip is to pretend to be streamers and to request keys, or pretend to be press and request keys. And then they get to sell those keys and they spent nothing. So you get a lot of drive-by requests for keys of that nature. And along those lines, you know, the fraud gets worse past these requests for keys for alleged streamers, because one of the worst incidents of or types of this sort of fraud is a key reseller steals somebody's credit card and then they buy like 100 keys from the developer. Then the person whose credit card was stolen reports the fraud and the credit card company does a chargeback on the developer. So the developer is out that money. They didn't receive any money, but now the key reseller has 100 keys and then they can just flip those on their site.
Oh, wow.
So I tell anybody, if you see a game on sale on a site that's not one you've heard of, like it's not Itch, it's not Steam, it's not GOG, don't buy it. Or ask the dev if they've published there, because something like G2A is one of the worst offenders in this regard. It's just better to pirate the game than to buy it from somebody like that.
You are currently working then on your sixth game, your newest one, which is Red Star Azimuth. Can you tell me a little bit about it?
Sure. It is a 3D first-person puzzle game, and the puzzles have a sort of hacking electricity theme to them. And it's a very narrative-focused game, and it tells the story about a cosmonaut in the 60s who has the power to hack reality, but they keep getting stuck in a loop, experiencing the same events over and over again.
Okay. How long has it been in production?
I began developing the story for this game in spring of 2017. And then I opened development, as in a code side, in January of 2018. So 2 years or a year and a half, depending on how you slice it.
Okay. Has anything changed about the story or the premise or anything since production started?
I was first approaching it thinking that it would be fun to do a pastiche of dating sims. And this was pretty shortly after Dream Daddy had become this big phenomenon. So I've joked before that it was set in anime high school. It was never actually set in high school. It was always set in the Soviet space program in the 60s. But in that regard, I was referring to, I think, the level of emotional realism one can expect and the level of emotional maturity one might expect from the characters. And I was developing it as a black comedy. And, you know, those are characterized by, well, in a typical story, a character has a major dilemma in the climax at the end. Mm-hmm. And the choice they make is determined by what they've learned along the way, right or wrong. In a black comedy, you know, at the end, there's sort of an obvious right or wrong choice, and the main character picks the wrong choice, so it's the audience that's supposed to have that revelation of what should have happened.
Yeah.
So that's how it was, and I shelved the project for a while to work on Simshine, and then after that to ship Slam Fighter 2. But after I shipped Slam Fighter 2 to Steam, I found myself looking at the project again, and I realized that I didn't respect the characters. And I didn't respect the genre of dating sim. So I realized this is a non-starter, so either I need to scrap this project altogether or I need to start again without having the premise that all of the characters are stupid and people you shouldn't feel sorry for. Mm. So I think that's the biggest change to it.
From the screenshots and things that you've shared on Twitter, it seems much bigger in scope and concept compared to your previous work. Was it difficult making the jump to making a, in quotes, bigger game?
Well, before I got into making games, I worked in enterprise software. So enterprise software being, you know, software for boring things and not video games. And
spreadsheets are not boring.
Oh, my. So enterprise dev is characterized by generally having a lot of rigid processes. Mm-hmm. Involved in making it. And I think part of it is, you know, you can't count on the developers working on enterprise software to just do so for the love of it.
Yeah.
Nobody's motivated by their extreme passion to work on Oracle databases or something like that. So you learn, if you work in enterprise dev, you know, how to plan milestones and how to set long-term goals. And so while doing that work as my day job, I had already experienced working towards a long-term goal, seeing myself achieve a long-term goal. So I've always taken this enterprise approach to my game dev. All my games have always been made in sprints, burn downs, and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. So to me, this is just an extension of what had been done before of doing another phase of an enterprise project, except this time it was my own project.
Yeah, okay. How much of a learning curve with respect to the coding and what have you, and obviously the game engine that you're using? Have you been using, say, online tutorials or anything, or just sort of learning as you go along with it?
This is my third game with the Unity engine. Mm-hmm. However, it's my first game in 3D. Mm-hmm. So I think with regards to the engine, Unity for 2D's learning curve is not terribly steep if you're already familiar with C Sharp, which I had been because the engine I'd used previously was XNA. Mm-hmm. 3D has a bit of a steep learning curve, and it kind of, I always knew it was kind of hard or complicated, but it did surprise me just how much more complicated making a game in 3D was than from 2D. Mm-hmm. I think I'm the kind of person who doesn't read the documentation until I'm in deep trouble. So I think a lot of it was muddling around and then looking up specific tutorials for the specific problem I found myself in at that time, which was probably a slower means of learning than actually properly sitting through all of the official Unity tutorials. But I have a big problem, and that's I really hate watching videos. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's because I have ADHD. I don't know. But sitting still and watching a video is a non-starter because I want to fidget or click into other windows. And the problem is most of the official Unity tutorials are videos. So I would have to say my favorite resource, or one of my favorite resources, would be Cat-like Coding. Mm-hmm. Which is a huge comprehensive set of tutorials mainly focused on graphics programming for Unity. They're all text. in blog and essay form. Love them. So if anybody listening wants to find Unity tutorials of that sort, they should check them out and support Cat-Like Coding on Patreon. I'm not affiliated with them in any way. They don't know who I am.
You have been making your own custom shaders as part of the development of Red Star Azimuth. You've also been doing then tutorials for those as well. Is that something that you had wanted to do to then share, or is it just something that you think should be out there?
With regards to the tutorials that I've been making recently, I approached them from the point of view of what are the tutorials I wish had existed when I first started writing shaders. And there's always this tricky thing with any kind of tutorial, and that's when you know how to do something, it can be more difficult than you realize to get in the mindset of someone who doesn't yet know how to do that thing. And a particular challenge for me when I first started looking at shaders, which was probably back in 2016 when I was trying to update Slame Fighter 2, which uses quite a few shaders, I was very new to programming in 2015, and so many tutorials presupposed quite a bit of knowledge that I didn't have that was not directly related to creating these tutorials. So this was something I'd wanted to do for a long time of how can I tutorialize this such that someone who doesn't know how to use Unity or maybe doesn't know how to program can maybe get started? And I suppose the value of that has, well, there's, I think, multiple things of, I think there's value in empowering people who enjoy games to know a little bit under the hood. So, you know, my tutorial series is not going to get you up to making like pro quality fancy VFX. But there are other tutorial series for that that I'd be happy to direct people to. But it will, you know, I think give some insight. But also developers have told me that they appreciated it because it helped them pick up missing gaps in their knowledge, which can easily happen if you're self-taught, where you know all these advanced things, but there's some basic thing that everybody else knows that you just never picked up because you didn't go to school for it or anything like that.
You have also been sharing a lot of pictures and GIFs and things of the development on social media. Has this helped to build an interest in the game?
Yes, definitely. So marketing an indie game is extremely difficult unless you are already famous or you have very deep pockets. And I am neither of those things. And I have taken a social media strategy, if you will, for Red Star Azimuth of I treat Twitter like my diary, my dev diary. So whether it's flattering to me or not, often it's not, I will be posting my progress quite regularly. And I decided to do this following the disappointing debut of Slame Fighter 2 on Steam. Slame Fighter 2, I had done some ad buys and I had done press releases and contacted quite a few outlets. And I even got a little bit, I got like two articles. I contacted streamers, I got streamed by a few people, and it was just overall very disappointing. And I had been posting to social media up to the release, but only the fancy stuff and only the, you know, the very curated version of what I wanted people to see. And I did not want that to happen to a future release, obviously. But I was thinking I can't increase my ad buy, let's say, and to really get streamers interested, you got to throw cash around. So what is something I do have control over? Well, there is social media. And I think it works because it makes people invested. People can see the game, follow what I've been doing. And as much as a parasocial relationship goes, because I don't know them and they don't know me, I guess I can be a character in my own story making a video game. I think it's been successful. I have had a Twitter account for 10 years. It's terrible. And I currently have nearly 3,000 followers, maybe more. It was getting close, but 2,000 of those I definitely got within the last year. And so that's 8 years of not much attention at all and 2 years. What is the differentiating factor? Well, it's posting quite a lot of work in progress images and videos of my game.
Yeah. your way, then obviously social media is working as a much better marketing tool. As you say, it's not even targeted marketing as such. It is just more of oversharing is actually generating the interest.
Well, I wouldn't think about it as oversharing because honestly, I don't think anybody is going to remember anything specific about what I share past like a day, if at all.
Yeah.
Nobody's going to remember the names of the characters, the details, the story, or anything like that. But what they will remember is the color palette, or they'll remember the overall aesthetic. And I think that's what you want people to carry with them anyway.
Yeah, definitely.
So I think it's not an issue of oversharing because that would be drastically overestimating how much attention people actually pay to me. I think if I had like a large established fan base or something, I would not use that strategy. I would be concerned about people, I don't know, piecing together the story or spoilers. But we'll be honest, nobody cares enough to try to like make a pin board with yarn and stuff and piece together the story of the game from what I've posted.
I'm sure there's somebody out there that is doing it.
You know, if it's like one guy out there or one girl out there doing that or anybody out there doing that, good for them. I'm glad that they're so motivated. Keep living your truth.
You also have a Patreon account. Has that been a useful tool to building an audience? And is it sustaining the production of the game in any way?
Well, I think it's a bit early to say. I think I opened up that Patreon account a month ago. Oh, okay. It was in that mad rush, you know, when Patreon announced they were going to be increasing their fees. And I've been flattered and very grateful for the response. I think I'm up to 150 roughly a month. And it's been interesting to see what gets pledges. Well, first of all, you know, all my game dev friends and I, we've all pledged to each other's Patreons. So Patreon is making money on our overhead. But so we're technically losing money, but we think it's worth it because there's an interesting aspect of social media and things like this of if people see that someone's already liking your stuff or already like giving to you, they're more likely to do that because it's like you've been vetted in a way. So even giving a dollar to a friend that gives a dollar to you via Patreon makes that visible, which can be helpful.
Yeah.
You know, you can see this phenomenon of if there's a tweet with a stupid joke and zero likes and a tweet with the same stupid joke and it's already got 10,000 likes, people are much more likely to engage with the one that already has all the engagement, which seems a bit paradoxical, like, you know, spread it around. But that's the way people's minds work. So I have noticed that I definitely got more interest from the tutorial series for beginners than I did from advanced stuff. So that's very interesting. We'll see how that develops.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I want to address something you said earlier. You said, you know, not doing targeted marketing on Twitter, but Twitter itself is targeted marketing because... it's sort of... But it's important to remember that for... Well, so the people who follow me on Twitter, the people I follow on Twitter are going to be industry people. They're going to be game devs. I follow a smattering of streamers, so maybe them too, but they're also sort of semi-industry. I don't follow a lot of average Joe gamers or average anybody gamers, and they don't follow me because we haven't heard of each other. So that's something important to keep in mind when it comes to response to anything you do on Twitter is that one's market for a video game is not other game devs. And this is a mistake that's easy to fall into. You should not aim your game at other game devs. You should aim your game at gamers. And I think I could point to a few case studies where I think devs made that misstep to their own detriment. So whatever response I get on Twitter, I do need to be aware that it's coming from the people who are the most plugged into industry news, the most passionate about indie games, and the most kind of technical and dirty on the game dev side, and to not get blinded by anything from that.
Yeah, there's always a worry that you're... For all the engagement and what have you that you're getting, you're not really getting anywhere near the people down the street who have recently bought a new console or whatever, or have a nice, a reasonable PC sitting in the corner of the room somewhere.
One thing that keeps me humble is remembering that the, well, one, the average gamer is playing a game on their mobile phone. But if we just talk about console and PC, the average gamer plays just one game a year, and that game is FIFA. So that'll keep you humble.
Yeah, that's very, very true. Yeah, or currently, what is it? Most of them go for what the freebie ones or whatever, like Fortnite, etc. And almost use them as a place to hang out and chat and not even necessarily as a game.
Yeah, and the thing that, you know, it kind of ties back into the issue of itch versus Steam and the Epic Store and so on is a enormous hurdle for any indie game being released to overcome is visibility. Because basically, this is true of most things. It's especially true of indie games. If you make a group of people aware that the game exists, statistically, some fraction of that group will be interested and buy it. So you have two angles to work when it comes to marketing a game. One is increasing awareness, so like making more people aware that the game exists to begin with. And then there is increasing the conversion rate, as it's called in sales, which means of the people who knew it exists, increasing the rate of people who actually plunk down money for it. And so doing things like any kind of targeted marketing, that targeted ad buys, even Twitter things, or going to trade shows like PAX or E3, these things increase your conversion rate. However, these do not really increase your actual total pool of people to draw from. It doesn't increase your awareness necessarily. So there's been a lot of fear in the indie community recently because of games that were expected to do very well that did not, in part because it looked like of the people who'd heard of them, a high number of people would convert, would buy, and yet these games were commercial disappointments in part because they didn't have enough visibility in terms of total people.
Yeah,
that's really difficult because these are problems that can be solved with a lot of money, but a lot of money is something that many indies don't have. And I think one of the first games that comes to mind that's been a victim to this would be Where the Water Tastes Like Wine. I don't know if you're familiar with that one.
I am aware of the game, yes.
Yeah, that was it was the one. It was about like telling stories in the Great Depression, and it had this beautiful woodblock carving print style, and it was super well received at PAX, and it won awards, and it got a lot of good press, and then it underperformed. And I remember the kind of some of the discourse around it was, oh, well, that looks cool, but I never heard about it. And a totally different game that I still think of on this topic is Echo. And it's that stealth action game. It looks really slick. It looks like it came from a AAA studio, and it's got super high production values. And that game was such a commercial failure that the studio that made it folded.
Yeah, that was only recently as well.
And folks I've talked to played it, liked it. And it looks, in the other thing I heard about it was, oh, that was cool. If I'd known about it, I would have bought it sooner.
Yep.
So it seems like the main common thread is not enough people knew about it. So I think that's the biggest battle that an indie faces.
Yeah. You have previously balanced the development of the Team Dogpit games alongside a normal day job, but you've recently made the decision to quit your day job and do development of Red Star Azimuth full time. How did you come to that decision?
That was a really difficult decision because I enjoyed my job and my colleagues. It came down to I had spent a year and a half basically working 40 hours at my day job and 40 hours at my second job. And so working, I think I was, my average, I think I was coming home by 5:30 and then getting on dev at 6 and continuing until 2 a.m. And I'm 29 years old, so that became a huge strain on my physical health. I cannot imagine anyone much older than me managing to do that. And I felt my own age start to come on of, I don't think I can keep doing this. So I made a calculated decision of, I don't think this is a good financial decision, but I think I've got a plan for completion. So for the sake of my health, I did quit my job, But I would, I think what made it work so long, though, was that I did treat making games as a job, something that was not optional.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the hardest thing for folks who try to do day job plus game dev is to not find the motivation or energy to do the game dev after the day job. And that's what I hear the most often from people who say, you know, how do you do it? And my answer is, it's not a choice.
Mm-hmm.
But that was, you know, to work 100 hours a week is detrimental to your social life and your health. So it's not something that should be done for a suspended period of time.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, I would encourage a lot of folks to try to keep their day job as long as possible, because I think having a day job, having something that takes you outside of video games is important to kind of, sounds cheesy, feed your mind.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
I think if you are a writer, it's important to read books that you're not writing. And I think if you're a musician, it's important to listen to music that you're not making.
Yeah.
And if you're a game dev, it's important to do some development and play some games that you are not creating.
Yeah.
So anything that facilitates that is good. If you make podcasts, you should listen to podcasts that are not your own podcast.
Yeah, I definitely do that. Yeah, that kind of fits in with, I was going to ask, sort of, is it's important to try and keep mindful of sort of a healthy balance then. And obviously you were talking about crunch there, but to a degree it was managed crunch because you were aware that that is what you were doing.
Well, I think that when you work for yourself, it's very easy to kind of push the limit of time you spend,
mm-hmm.
or anything you feel ownership over. But I think that what I was doing was probably not good, and I wouldn't encourage people to work themselves that much. But one thing that I think was a good idea that I continue to do is I did set boundaries between day job, game dev job, and family and friends and that sort of thing of this time is earmarked for this. Other things don't happen in this time.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a two-way street of this is game dev time. This is not time for playing games, you know, other people's games, or being on social media. Like if you were to look up my Twitter posting time, you'll notice that between the hours of 6 and midnight, there's almost nothing from me happening there. And on the inverse of if I'm with my family, I'm not checking my game dev email or my work email, and I'm not looking at those things because this is, you know, in dev they call it time boxing. This is time box for this purpose. And I think it's important for anybody who freelances or does anything like that to use that, or else everything's going to bleed together and then you will never have free time and you'll never be fully dedicated to your work.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I'd noticed about your games is that you have a lot of voice actors for them.
Mm-hmm.
I was just wondering, how easy or difficult is it to get voice actors for an indie game? And what, if any, costs are involved?
So it's sort of an interesting open secret that pretty much any voice actor you can think of will say anything you want for money. And they don't really care who you are, as long as you have money. I mean, obviously some are not going to do something pornographic, but you know, you can shoot an email to almost anybody who does voice acting, and if you pay them enough, they don't care. They will do it happily. So I had the advantage of being friends with several voice actors already, because I dated a voice actor for a while,
mm-hmm.
like a few years, and their friends became my friends and that sort of thing. So I lost that. I think sometimes people are intimidated, especially if they're approaching people who've worked in a property that they admire. But they're just human. So to cast these games, this is the same process for Red Star Azimuth as it was for Slam Fighter 2. I first created a casting list, and what that is that's a list of voice actors that you would want to cast potentially. And you can create one for yourself just by finding voice actors you like. You know, you listen to something, you're a voice actor, look up their website, write down their email. Voice actors I was friends with on Twitter, voice actors I was friends with in real life, and creating this list. And the next step is to create an audition. So, you know, they call these, well, so you make a document and your first page describes the project and the rate of pay and the due date, et cetera, and so on. And then each page, generally you have like a page or section for each character, and these are called slides. And each slide has a description of the character and usually a picture and usually three lines of that character. And then you email everybody in your casting list. Please use blind carbon copy, or else people will get very mad. And just wait for people to start sending you auditions.
Oh, okay.
So there is an excellent indie rate guide, whose name I've forgotten, so I'll have to send it to you later, that's good to look at for what rate to offer the talent, because if the rate is too low, well, you won't get auditions. But if the price is right... Mm-hmm. I remember being excited because when I set out the casting call for Slam Fighter 2, which had to be recast before I put it on Steam for various reasons, I got an audition back from Mike Pollock, who's the voice of Dr. Robotnik in the Sonic stuff.
Uh-huh.
It's like, what? He actually, like, auditioned? Because that was sort of a, you know, your casting list is almost like a wish list.
Yeah.
And I've got some folks in Red Star Azimuth that I'm really excited, like, wow, they actually, like... They deigned to step down to interact with this mortal I am. So what is common at the moment is to offer between, if you're on a per line rate, $2 to $3 per line.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you're on an hourly rate for indie, it's like $100 to $200 per hour.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is expensive, but it's not out of reach.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people don't realize. I've seen some weird comments that people have made towards voice actors of, oh, voice actors must be rich. No, they're really not. Because you have to keep in mind that if they make $100 in a one-hour session, their week is not full of sessions like that.
Yeah.
Their week is like mostly spent looking for work, and then they have a few sessions. And so those few sessions have to make up for the times that they don't have work.
Mm-hmm.
They're also, so I used a closed casting call because I felt my casting list was large enough that I would get enough responses to cast my game. However, if someone is not feeling confident enough or they feel like they don't have a big enough list, there's also open casting calls. And that is when you announce that you are casting and you have a link that is public to your audition slides. And you can do this via social media, and there are various places like Casting Call Club and I think like voiceactors.com or something. And a lot of people cast through there. The downside to that is you will be buried in responses, and many of those responses will be low quality. And by low quality, I often literally mean their audio recording quality is poor, like they auditioned with a webcam mic.
Yeah.
Even if you make it clear in your first page, like broadcast quality. Audio only. Mm-hmm. But they're both valid strats. So if folks want to give it a shot, you should give it a shot.
Yeah. Just going back to Red Star Azimuth then, when do you hope to release it? And have you looked at the release calendar for other games? Although at the minute, I'm sure the market is just so much of a mess now that trying to strategize that is very, very difficult.
Well, so the plan has always been to release in 2020.
Mm-hmm.
And The general consensus about release dates is that it doesn't really matter the season, you know, winter, summer, fall, whatever, in which you release. However, you must make sure that you do not release during a store-wide Steam sale, where you'll be buried.
Mm-hmm.
And you must not release during a really big industry event such as E3.
Yeah.
Because no one will... care about your game coming out because they just announced, you know, the next Zelda or what have you.
Mm-hmm.
Past that and past releasing in the shadow of a massive AAA game, the general consensus is that there's not really any more advantageous time than another.
Yeah, fair enough. What about the success of it as a launch? There's enough devs will say that basically getting it out the door and as a finished product is enough of a success in itself. But do you have an idea of sort of the numbers in your head? You don't have to say what they are or anything. Or is it a case of Red Star Azimuth being almost like a financial make or break situation?
So I've always had a policy that I will never go into debt to make this game.
Mm-hmm.
And fortunately, I've had the means to do so. And one thing that's definitely humbled me working on this project is realizing if I didn't have as much money, or if I had a family or had other obligations, I would not have been able to make that game. And I think it's important to reflect on, you know, do we want to live in a world in which only people who have some means can make indie games?
Mm-hmm.
But so fortunately, I can eat the loss if I have to. I would rather not, but I can eat the loss and I'll be okay.
Yeah.
And as far as a successful launch, I would love to make back what I spent. I think so far it's in the area of 20K. It's US dollars. Oh, okay. That is a shoestring budget for a video game.
Yeah.
It's like nothing. And it is so low because I am a generalist and I can do a lot of things that many people have to hire a team for.
Yeah.
Which goes back to the earlier thing of, do we only want generalists with these situations or circumstances to be able to make games? I would like to see an environment in which people, you know, could make a game even if they didn't have the means to do so, or they didn't have the time and so on.
Mm-hmm.
I've always thought that making it to the finish line is the most important part of making a game. The most important part of making a game is finishing the game. And finishing something is a skill that people don't appreciate.
Mm-hmm.
Just as writing a prologue is a skill, wrapping something up is a skill. And I have a lot of friends who have had games that were commercially successful that don't look extremely fancy. Like, I'm friends with Marvin, who made Shower With Your Dad Simulator 2015. Do You Still Shower With Your Dad?
Mm-hmm.
Which was a commercial success. And there were a lot of people making angry comments on the internet about it of, well, I could have made that. He doesn't deserve to be successful. And I always think, but you didn't. You didn't.
Yeah.
You think you can make that, but you didn't. And doing that is harder than you think. I think it's a sort of Dunning-Kruger of, if somebody knows that they can program like a character to hop, then they think that they could make Mario. But there's a lot more to making games than what appears on the surface.
Yeah.
And there's a legend in some game dev circles, the legend of the white dragon. And there's this guy, and his handle was the white dragon. And this was in like the XNA days before Unity. So XNA was a game engine which did not have a visual editor. It's code only.
Mm-hmm.
And he created a game in which all of the code was contained in one single class, in one single file. Which I don't know how familiar you are with coding. This is considered not just a bad practice, but a wildly absurd beggar's belief practice. but he even shared his code for all to see, and it was, from all points of view, coded very poorly. Very strange decisions and not the proper way of doing things at all. But the game worked. It was greenlit. This was back in the greenlight days. And he made back what he spent. It was a success.
Yeah.
So I would say he's an excellent developer because he finished his game. so you have a game with beautiful graphics and beautiful code and all the process has been done correctly, but it's not finished. That is a worse game than the White Dragon's game.
Very, very true, yes. No, Ed, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. I have three quick questions just to finish off the interview with. First one is, what or who influences your work?
The biggest influence on my work would be theater. I mentioned I got into game dev later in life. I started out being really into drama. I was trained as a playwright. I was mentored by a playwright that I respect very much. And in many regards, I believe that producing a play requires many of the same skills as making a video game. It's very multidisciplinary. And so I would say maybe the biggest influence, if I were to cite a person other than my mentor, would be Lajos Egri. It's a Hungarian playwright who wrote The Art of Dramatic Writing. And I recommend anybody pick it up. It's about writing plays, but I think it's got a lot of points that are applicable in a sort of philosophical way to making video games. So yeah, you should check it out.
Do you have an unfinished project that you still plan on going back to?
I do. So in early 2016, I released a game called Hashtag Everest, and it made fun of rich people who climb Mount Everest and die, which is a bit, it's a bit macabre, it's a bit mean, but That game, I'm very proud of it because I think it had some of the best integration of storytelling and gameplay. It was a sim game, and the story worked really well with, it was like, you know, this egotistical guy trying to get likes on, we made it up, it was Brostagram. He wanted to get likes on Brostagram for climbing Mount Everest. And that game is complete, so to speak. However, I used some images of some real life people that I probably shouldn't have. it's an XNA, so the outdated engine. So I do have a project on the back burner that I kind of pick at if I want to take a break from Red Star, but I still want to like tinker with something. Yeah. So I'm planning on refreshing that, removing any references to real life people and any photos of them. And
please tell me you're leaving the Obama cutout in though.
Okay, Obama can stay.
Yay!
Oh, you've played it. Have you played it?
Yes, I have. I played it the other night there, so it is.
I'm so flattered.
As part of my research for the show, I try and play as many of the games that anybody that I have on has actually made and things like that. So yes, I did go back and play that.
That game was tricky because people had a hard time getting that. You know, there are not a lot of stated objectives other than get a high score. And so some people got frustrated at the game because of that, because it's a sort of Oregon Trail-esque game. Mm-hmm. But one thing I wish to make more clear is the fun I found in playing my own game was setting my own challenges. So between my friends at the time, we came up with something called the Piano Run. And the Piano Run involves making it to the summit with four pianos. It can be done. I've done it. It's difficult. But if you're looking for an extra challenge in hashtag Everest, you should do the Piano Run. So now what I should do is, you know, add that as an achievement on Steam. And then people will say, oh, well, there's my objective. Because it's a score attack game. People are like, so how do I like survive? And I'm like, no, you die. You'll never not die. The only question is when. It's a bit dark, yes. But the paper doll of the main character uses is edited from a photo of a real person who died. And that is a bit much. So I want to go back and not actually use the photo of a dead person. So it'll be on the back burner. We'll see when that comes out.
Last question then is, what one thing do you wish was easier about making games?
Not enough hours in the day. I wish there were more hours in the day. Making games is much more time consuming. Programming is much more time consuming than anyone realizes. This is why I encourage, this is a practice from enterprise dev that I think all game devs should follow. Estimate how long it will take to do something, then keep track of how long it took, and compare with your estimation. This will over time make you better at estimating. It's so time consuming. I just wish I had more time.
Yeah. I think that's just life in general, but yes, particularly whenever you're focusing on certain tasks and things. Yeah, absolutely.
Yes.
Oh, it has been an absolute pleasure having you on, Manuela. If people want to get in contact with you, how do they go about it?
They can shoot me an email, info@teamdogpit.com, or they can come say hi on Twitter, Team Dogpit on Twitter, or Manuela Shibanya. You can say hi. Love to say hi back. And ask me any questions if you have any.
Cool. As for me, I'm your host, Stuart Neil. You can get in contact with the show via Twitter at howtomakeagame. That's the number 2. You can get us on email, which is howtomakeagamecast@gmail.com. And if you want to get in contact with me personally, I'm at saintlystuart on Twitter as well. Thank you very much, Manuela. That has been an absolutely brilliant interview. I really enjoyed that. And yeah, that was really, really good.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, it was an absolute pleasure. So, for this show, thank you and goodbye.
Later, folks.